You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
Were any of you here to hear Nick Lowles yesterday?
Yeah.
The brilliant Nick Lowles ended his talk with a cheeky introduction to the very serious, pressing, concerning phenomenon of Christian nationalism. And we promised from the stage yesterday that this subject would be opened up for Greenbelt today and tomorrow. This is the first of two sessions which we're delighted to introduce. We have a wonderful panel. Were any of you here to hear Lucy Winkett earlier today? So Lucy joins the panel, which will be introduced by its chair, by the legendary Chinne McDonald, who needs no introduction from me. Please welcome Chinne, Lucy, Julie and Pete to the stage.
Good morning, Greenbelt. So 2 years ago, I don't think we had anything about Christian nationalism on the programme at Greenbelt. But this weekend, you can't really move for panels about this conversation. It seems to be everywhere. A couple of days ago, I was on the train home to South East London, and I heard a few rows before me, a normal person saying, oh, this Christian nationalism stuff, oh, these fascists, all this. I was like, this is a conversation that is seeping into every part of our public life. This conversation, this panel, is trying to set up what exactly we mean when we talk about Christian nationalism from our different perspectives. There are several panels over the weekend that are going to dig into different aspects of it. We're trying to unpack it a little bit. And because of that, in my day job as director of Theos, I've been asked in this panel to just share some of the work that we are doing into this area. So we are doing a comparative study of Christian nationalism in five European countries, one of those being the UK. We've also got France, Hungary, Poland, and Romania. And we're exploring what exactly it looks like in those different countries. And what we're trying to do is to move away from this kind of knee-jerk, pejorative understanding of what Christian nationalism is, to try and go a little bit deeper, to unpack it, but also to recognise where it is problematic. Before I introduce the panel, I want to just share just a few of the kind of early findings from the first bit of research that we've released, which is on our website, theosthinktank.co.uk. We're defining it principally in terms of the linking of Christianity and nationhood. The idea that being authentically British and being Christian are in some way bound together. And we've done some kind of extensive polling on this, and actually it's much more complicated than you might think. 17% of UK adults agree that you need to be Christian to be truly British. 17% of people believe that you need to be Christian to be truly British. 16% that people who do not hold Christian values do not belong in Britain. But only 1% say being Christian is the most important factor in being truly British. But then there are some kind of substantially larger minorities who favour a kind of more loose connection between the two, between Christianity and the state. So, for example, 41% agree that British law should be based on Christian values. 41% agree that British law should be based on Christian values. So one of the things that we're exploring in this conversation is basically how big of a problem is it? Is it actually very small and it's just potentially loud and getting a lot of attention? Or are there a substantial shift in how we relate Christianity, politics, our public life together? So some of the things we'll dig into are around what exactly we're seeing in our different spheres. So with me, I have Julie Siddiqui, who is a mentor, consultant, and gender equality campaigner with a focus on interfaith relations. And she applies that to social action work and has a background in community grassroots work spanning 30 years. Then Reverend Lucy Winkett, theologian, broadcaster and rector at St James's Piccadilly, who represented us all on the Guilty Feminist podcast on Christian nationalism, which I was very proud to see. And Pete Morey, who is from Christian Aid, head of community and church fundraising at Christian Aid. And in Pete's role, he's been exploring this issue and what the church response to the question of Christian nationalism should be. So as we begin, I'd like to invite each panelist, starting with Julie, to share 2 to 3 minutes on when you look at Christian nationalism in Britain today, what do you think we most need to understand about what's actually happening and what might we be in danger of misunderstanding?
Yeah. Good morning, everyone. Assalamu alaikum. Peace be upon you all. It's really quite overwhelming and beautiful to be here. And I've been to Greenbelt a number of times, either as a regular punter or as a speaker, but I just want to say that I always feel so very welcome here and very much part of the family. So it's really an honour to be here today speaking on this issue. It's so interesting when you were just talking then, it just came to me about the point you made about Christian values, and I just can't help thinking that, yeah, I think I certainly, all of us would sign up to Christian values being so very important actually for this country. But unfortunately, the people that so-called talk about Christian values are often the ones that don't show any sense of Christian values at all. Actually don't seem to follow the teachings of Jesus well either. So it's always interesting to me when the people that are kind of shouting and screaming and doing silly things are absolutely not embodying anything that I see as Christian values at all. I think one of the things that really came to me, and for those that were in Nick's talk yesterday, it was very motivating, also very sobering, very scary for someone who's been on the front line for many, many decades, stood here and said, and has said before, and will say again, that this is the most dangerous time he's ever seen. That's somebody, so we have to listen to that. And I think that for me, one of the things that we definitely need to acknowledge and do much better at is I think we've allowed the wrong people to try and shape the conversations about what it means to be British, English, what our sense of belonging is in this country. And we've just, the wrong people have been setting the agenda, which Nick also alluded to yesterday as well. And just to say that when I thought about timing and how long I've been seeing this, if you like, misappropriation of Christian symbols in this space, I think back to 2014, even before that, so you're talking 12 plus years ago, the whole kind of leading up to Brexit and Paul Golding, who's head of Britain First, standing outside and going into mosques, in fact, but standing on Facebook, live streaming to thousands and thousands of people pretty much every day outside a mosque with a big cross and walking down the street. And I remember feeling very alarmed and scared by it, but also, I guess, surprised and a bit disappointed that more of us Christians and others weren't saying, hold on, this isn't actually okay. And it isn't just a fringe group. And it got more and more. And if you think about Joe Cox, you know, was murdered 10 years ago, and the guy that did that said those words, Britain First. And obviously they were all in denial. Oh, it's nothing to do with us. It's like, well, actually, let's just be real about this. It isn't just a fringe group. And they were eventually banned, but are still active and whatever. So I think that happening over years, this isn't a new thing. We've been seeing this rising and rising. And if you think about how that then relates to the whole conversation about migrants, stop the boats, which essentially means stop the boats equals stop the Muslims. And it's become, as Nick said yesterday, very, very mainstream, and how that links then with crosses and the St. George flag. And we have to have those conversations. It isn't straightforward and it is complicated, and Muslims don't always do the right things either, of course. But we have to have the conversations, but not allow people that are at the moment setting that agenda to be the ones that set the agenda.
Lucy, what are you seeing from where you are?
In the preparation for this, I think you said maybe we could say when we sort of personally thought, okay, this is a problem. I think that's such a good question. And I was thinking, I think it was maybe 10 years ago that I was at Greenbelt talking as the English representative on a panel with English, Scottish, Welsh and Irish talking about the United Kingdom. And It was the maybe 10 years ago. It was one of the first times. I mean, I'm colossally old, so I feel embarrassed about saying this, but it was probably one of the first times I thought, oh, yeah, I'm English, as publicly English. I came out as English in this panel. It was quite an interesting thing to think about. But that was in terms of Britain and at that time devolution. That was the terms of the debate, which are and it's different now. So I went back to the village that I grew up in. I was born actually in Salisbury, which I always say to Nick Papadopoulos here is the Dean of Salisbury. So I always love going to Salisbury because I see Stonehenge and I think that's, you know, it's where I landed. But it's what I'm trying to say by that is I feel now English as well as British in a way that has been curious. I'm curious about that for myself. So I went back to the village that I grew up in, which is in Buckinghamshire, last year to visit my mum and dad, and there were St. George's flags all over the village, and I was outraged. I was furious, and I just immediately thought, not in my name, what are you doing? And I was judging the motivation of the people who were putting those flags up, and as others have said, I was impressed in a way by the efficiency of it. They were all down a road exactly the same, you know, level on the lamppost. Somebody had taken a lot of care. This was really serious logistics. And I thought, these must be people that I went to school with and, or at least know in my village. So I thought about that a lot. And then I live in the middle of London next to the church, Piccadilly, and Tommy Robinson's carol service was quite close. So I went to it sort of on the fringes of it. I wanted to see what was being said. And the thing, one of the images that stayed with me was, and this is to your point, it's anti-Muslim. So the point was, there was a woman with her family, and they looked like they were having a good time, but they had a huge banner which said Deus vult, which is the Latin 11th century slogan for the Crusades, God wills. And I thought, I don't know. I would love to have asked her. I didn't ask her. I wanted to ask her whether she understood the import of the banner that was being carried. It had been made. It wasn't an ad hoc thing. It was organised. So I think those two things together have led me to think that as a person who lives now less than 3 hours from where I was born, and have the freedom to travel, but I am living in the country I was born in, and I'm living less than 3 hours from where I was born. I said that we must have this conversation more loudly and not allow the definition of what it is to be English and what it is to be British to be taken over by one very narrow and highly problematic definition of that term. So I felt, when I saw the flags, I felt angry, and it was really not in my name. So I want us to be louder.
So we'll come back to that shortly, but Pete, what are you thinking?
I'm thinking that I was asleep to this threat. I think listening to Julie and Lucy talking about it from 10, 15 years ago, I think really I woke up to it when the Unite the Kingdom march happened in September last year. And I was totally unaware of it. I didn't even know that it was happening, and then was scrolling, you know, BBC News on that Saturday, and suddenly saw it. And my first thought was my then 15-year-old son, who happened to be in London with his mates. And I thought, oh, no, like, is he all right? Is he going to be safe? So suddenly was texting him to make sure that he was being sensible while this march led by these far right groups was happening. And I guess in doing that, you know, I looked at the news coverage. And of course, what did we see immediately, in a way that I don't think I've ever really seen in the way that we saw in the Unite the Kingdom march, was crosses being borne banners of Christ as King, the Lord's Prayer being recited and so on. And for me, it was a total wake-up call. And the following day, on the Sunday, I was at a prayer meeting at my church in South London, in Crystal Palace, where I live. And I was praying with an older black woman in our congregation. And before we prayed, she said to me, I was like, what do you want to pray about? She said, I want to pray about what happened yesterday. She said, Pete, I haven't felt like this since the 1970s and early 1980s. You know, this brings back memories of what it was like to be a black woman in South London when the National Front were on the streets. And again, that just was a massive wake-up call for me to think that, you know, friends, sisters, brothers in my congregation were feeling like that was a total wake-up call. And I think what is happening is that the symbols of our faith, crosses, the Lord's Prayer, are being appropriated by the far right. People are being mobilized under those banners, and people are being intimidated. They're being made scared under the name of Jesus Christ. And I think we have a response responsibility to respond to that. I think we have to respond.
Thank you.
So this is all such a fascinating conversation to me. I wrote a book that came out in 2021 called God Is Not a White Man. Nowhere did I think about discussing this issue, it just wasn't a thing. When I was describing things like this or the January 6th insurrection, that's where I was thinking of Christian nationalism. It's an American thing. It's an American fundamentalist evangelical thing. But is it? Because we're talking about 2014. We're talking about things that have actually been under the surface for decades. What is it about this particular moment, do you think, that has led to this being much of a bigger deal? I know we're not political analysts, but what, from your perspectives, what is it about this time that has made it resurface?
So, I mean, yeah, I think, so there's very strong links between what's happening here and what's happening in America now. So it's not a surprise that people were flown in to those rallies. And obviously before that, it's been funded millions of dollars and pounds. It hasn't just happened by accident. Like, this stuff is happening and well-funded and well-organized. That's the scary bit for me. Like, it's not just a random thing. And I think that if you think about, even if we just think about 2014 to now, so 12 years, but it was before that, but let's just for argument's sake, say 12 years on. And then you think about the government in between that time and the, in a way, the allowance of certain narratives that not only were allowed to just carry on, but were then actually spoken out loud by actual politicians in actual office, even prime ministers, let me say. Like, where, of course this is going to get, worse. And I think that what's happened is people have just become more and more emboldened because of that allowance. And so now it's sort of open season. You know, anti-Muslim sentiment, which frankly is what this is, there's no way you can detach it. It is that. It always was that. It was that when it was Brexit. It just was couched in different language, but now it's not even couched in any language. It's very open. You know, the I've been around a long time looking online and things, and if you have an article now with anything to do with Islam or Muslims on a local newspaper or a local authority, you know, I wouldn't want you to look at the comments, but look at the comments. And these are not any longer bots and all of that. This idea that, oh, it's just people are bots. No, it isn't. This is, you know, the guy around the corner. And there was a recent article where I live, and a Muslim woman actually said to me, like, very genuinely, it's quite upsetting for me to hear it, even now as I'm thinking about it, that she's quietly said to me, having seen one of these terrible threads of comments and vile anti-Muslim openly stuff, do these people live around here? And it's like, yeah, they actually do, you know. And when you talk about people feeling frightened and the intimidation of flags, and I think about the riots, of course, which we haven't mentioned yet, of 2024, it was very open. And again, the speed in which those riots were galvanized was really scary. So many people saying, honestly, in my life, I did not imagine this would be happening. Like, where the heck did that come from? How did it happen so quickly? So again, I think we're all good people here. We don't hang out on those forums and in those WhatsApp groups, but they are there and they've been gathering and doing this stuff for a long time. And I think they've been emboldened both by actual politicians allowing this language to carry on and not say anything, and people like all of us, frankly, not doing enough and not speaking up enough. And I felt disappointed from a, I'm just being frank here, right, because I think I can, from a Christian Muslim perspective, the work hasn't been good enough. And also leading up to that rally, it may have come as a surprise to some, it didn't come as a surprise to the rest of us. And I think to myself, where were the actual, if you like, leaders and Christian, the up front, not afterwards, because afterwards it caught everyone a bit like, oh, what happened there? Where were those crosses and where did all that come from? So I felt a bit disappointed. And then the second one and others have been a lot better in terms of we need to be much more proactive. I just think we've also been too nice, like people like all of us. We haven't been organised enough. We haven't put the money in enough. We haven't done enough. And it hasn't come out of nowhere. Like, it's been funded and well organised. They're really good at comms. If you think about GB News and all the other things that Nick talked about yesterday, it's all connected. It's not just out of nowhere. So, you know, the lady that had the banner, I'm almost certain she did know what was written on that banner. Like, it's all part, you know, that's the scary bit for me. It's very well organised and very well funded. And, you know, as Nick said, it's the worst, and, you know, it's not the doom and gloom, and we'll go into the good stuff afterwards, hopefully at the end at least. But that's the reality, I think, that I'm seeing and that people like me and others are seeing. And it feels really very scary.
Yeah, we'll take a sharp turn and end with positives, by the way, at the end. Can I just stick with you for a moment, Julie? Because I want to just maybe unpack a little bit the Islamophobia. Because I think that what is underneath Islamophobia is racism. That Islam potentially represents something else, basically not us in some people's imagination. Is that your reading? Or is there something, do you think that Tommy Robinson understands the intricacies of Islam?
Well, he certainly claims to. I don't know if you've ever seen any of it. He stands there quoting verses out of context, of course, verses from the Quran and all of that. Look, frankly, I would be up for having a conversation with anybody about out of context scriptures. And I'd also be up for, and have been up for, speaking to anybody about the bad stuff that Muslims have done and are continuing to do. Right. I feel like as a Muslim, I became Muslim in my 20s, and from sort of late 90s, before 9/11, there were lots of us as Muslims trying to think, do you know what? The people in this country, we are part of this country. We're born and brought up here, all of that. And people need to understand Islam and Muslims much better than what they do at the moment, right? Because the sort of anti-Muslim stuff was there, but nowhere near like this. Of course, 9/11 happened and everything went upside down. Then we had our own, the most horrendous thing I think I've ever felt was 7/7 and the all of that. And that they were local, brought up here Muslims. And Muslims had to, and still have to, confront that stuff as well. Like, difficult, horrible things have happened and continue to happen. But so we need to have those conversations. And I think that what happened is, like grooming is an issue. Let's talk about grooming. Let's people like us talk about it. What are we going to do about it? How is it allowed to happen? But again, going back to my first point, we've allowed the wrong people to set those agendas. Then, of course, the rest of us end up being on the back foot or defensive. So Muslims have ended up going back into a corner. I don't want to talk to anybody about anything. We need to just work with each other. And, of course, that doesn't help us either. So I think it's, you know, it's deliberate. A bit like anti-Semitism. It ain't new, right? And so, you know, the anti-Muslim, and then the Christian-Muslim element of this is also not new. Right? You talked about the crusade. None of that is easy to talk about, is it? None of those things are easy to talk about, but we have to. Like, we need to have the conversations and bring it out, and people like us to do a bit more, not just kind of go around the edges. Because if we don't, we see what was happening. They think they are the ones that can be the crusaders now and not have any consequences. But the crusade stuff and all of that, there's always been that difficult relation stuff, right? History and currently. And let's not pretend that isn't there, because these things are difficult, but let's us have it, not allow them to set the agenda, because clearly there is an agenda. And that hasn't helped us, and now we are where we are, and it's very dangerous and very urgent.
Pete, I'm going to come to you in a moment just to think about how Christian nationalism is situated within the wider nationalist movement. But Lucy, when you were talking about, when you were saying kind of not in my name, I know, I'm not assuming that everyone in this tent feels the same about this issue. And I wonder whether sometimes when we speak out and say not in my name, it might be seen as utter woke nonsense, as people like to talk about Greenbelt. But how do you kind of tread that line?
Yeah, I think that's really, and I think that's super important. We mustn't assume that everybody in this tent or in this festival believes the same thing about this, or is coming from the same perspective. I think there's so perhaps I can build or add to what you're saying about racism and Islamophobia. I think that so one of the things I've been thinking about in terms of church, and I suppose it is the Church of England, just because that's the one I'm in. But I mean, I've just said it: Church of England, Christian nationalism. It's right there at the heart of our established constitution. So a thoughtful discussion about what Christian nationalism is urgent. Because it's the context that some of the Christianity practiced in this country is being done in. That is the context. So the weaponizing of Christian symbols and the weaponizing of Christian theology is something that there is already potentially an infrastructure to confront it. But I suppose speaking for myself, the Church of England is seen as, and quote, is it a weak institution that is not able to say things strongly enough, even in Parliament, to the extent that the post-Brexit division of people who live in England, the somewheres and the anywheres, and I was talking a little bit about this earlier, that people who feel connected to the place that they're in and therefore feel threatened by anybody they think is coming to be in their place and their sense of ownership there, that narrative has been allowed to be allied with a really toxic narrative of racism. And the Church of England, in being able to face the contested histories that we're absolutely complicit in and part of, has not been strong enough. So I think there's a sort of post-war consensus that after the horrors of the two world wars, you know, generated in Europe, but did also affect, you know, millions of people around the world, that the theologies of Christianity focus more on crucifixion than resurrection, because God didn't help, God didn't stop this suffering. So therefore, the theological environment became one of failure, if I can put it like that, or that failure and weakness or thoughtfulness was seen to be the way to go in a middle class church that became detached from its people. And that's not true of other denominations. It's not true of Methodism, and it's not true of Roman Catholicism. So the Church of England, I think, has a unique challenge in that, or a particular challenge in that, becoming detached. But what I think there is a potential to say, reconnect with that narrative of place and heritage in a way that's more honest and that is stronger and clearer. And then it's really obvious to anybody who identifies as English that Anglo-Saxon is in itself a multicultural society, even if I can use that phrase anymore. That's in itself. So it's utter nonsense, these narratives. And to try to talk from that perspective about those and call out those narratives is important, to your point, Julie, to have hard conversations and to recognise the complacency that I've been part of. It's important to try to face it and then say, okay, what do we do about it now? And it's difficult, but it has to be done. And I think reclaiming the post-Brexit narrative is one of the things that the Church of England has absolutely the capacity to do, because as I was saying in my talk earlier, we're all somebody of somewhere. There is that image of place and that commitment to place that could then turn that narrative and make it something much more inclusive, facing contemporary racism and calling it out, but making an inclusive vision of the future part of what the church is contributing to society. There is the potential for that, but we're a long way from it.
I could stay with that for hours, but I'm going to move on to Pete. So I think my wake-up call to this conversation was a couple of years ago. I was invited to apprentice pre-screening of this Channel 4 documentary with Hope Not Hate called Exposing the Far Right or Undercover the Far Right. And it was at Channel 4 and they'd invited like black community leaders to watch it. I was watching this film and I was just feeling very viscerally impacted by the symbols. So, you know, at the marches you were seeing, you know, when they were going off to, say, Poland, very white Jesus on kind of banners. You were seeing they had Paul Golding and I think he has daily Bible verses on X and things like that. And I remember asking a question afterwards, which was, you know, for you as a secular organization, Hope Not Hate, engaged in conversations about nationalism, had you picked up on the stuff? Because that's all I could see. And they kind of were like, yeah, kind of, but it wasn't the top line. It was like, it was a race question, not necessarily a religion one. So for you, from what you're seeing, where does Christian nationalism fit in within the kind of wider nationalist and far-right conversation?
I just want to say quickly to start that, I'm cautious about using it in terms of the wider nationalist, that word, movement, not least because there's Scottish and Welsh nationalism, which I think we all know are very different things. So I tend to talk more about the rise of the far right and extremism. So I just want to be cautious about that. But I think you're right. And I think what's interesting, and we heard it from Nick yesterday, this has rapidly risen up Hope Not Hate and the wider anti-fascist movement's agenda. So Christian Aid, along with a number of charities after Unite the Kingdom, did go to Hope Not Hate and say, you know, we need to take this more seriously. What can we do about this together? And that's led to us and many others. Nick talked yesterday about A Million Acts of Hope, and I might mention that again towards the end of our time together, which 250 really big, well-known household name charities, as well as right down to local community groups, got involved with, because we all realized that we need to wake up, we need to do something about this. And I think in conversations with Hope Not Hate, it's become really clear that they do see this as a really serious threat and a kind of critical element of the far right playbook, I guess, in the UK today. So, you know, they would say, like, yeah, as you mentioned, 2-3 years ago, yes, you were seeing crosses, but the kind of prevalence of that, the prevalence of how it's being used has just gone up exponentially over the last 12, 18 months. And there are a number of different elements that they, Hope Not Hate, and that wider movement are worried about, I think, which we need to take seriously. Despite the fact, of course, that the individuals within churches who are visible on their stages are in very, very fringe congregations and churches. To Hope Not Hate and those others, that doesn't matter, really, because what they say is it gives moral legitimacy to far-right movements. You know, by having a very fringe bishop from a very small congregation, it absolutely gives moral legitimacy. They also talk about the fact that, you know, Christian nationalism acts almost as a protective shield to these extremist views. So, you know, people are able to stand on stages, say things and say, you know, this is because of my Christian faith. And so it acts, you know, as this protective shield to those increasing far-right views that we're seeing in our society. It's attractive to some people. So, you know, I think Hope Not Hate are really conscious that extremism anyway is attractive to certain vulnerable individuals. And the spiritual dimension of it also acts as an attraction. So it's almost like a double attraction to some people who might be, who might tend to get involved in extremist movements and far right movements. So I think all of that is why Even if we were to look at, you know, the Theos findings, which I think are really helpful, and to say, well, actually, the manifestation of this in some instances is quite small. You know, as Julia said, Nick is saying this is the most dangerous time that he's ever seen. And they are saying to us, central to that is the appropriation of Christian symbols and messages and the use of the Christian faith to attract and mobilize people to it. So I think we have to take that really, really seriously.
Yeah. I just want to also say that, you know, I won't assume anybody here went to any of those rallies, although they may have done. And the reason I mention it is because actually you will definitely have people here who know people who did. And so I think we also need to acknowledge that it's complex, right? Because I spoke to a journalist who spent about 6 hours at the more recent rally that was in London, just talking and interviewing people and got snippets of... And lots of the people that were there were nowhere near as terrible as what was coming from the stage. And I very much acknowledge, I live in an area where there's a lot of economic challenges, for example, and the cost of living and all the things we know about and identity and what it means to be a man and all these different conversations that are also behind and around all of this. And so that's why I come from the premise that, first of all, we have to listen to everyone. Don't just dismiss people too quickly. Of course, the sort of very dangerous, if you like, leaders, in inverted commas, of these things, I mean, for me, is extremely problematic. But lots of the people that turn up at these things or follow these groups or, you know, I mean, you had a very neat and tidy row of flags. It isn't the case everywhere, of course. Some of them are just shambles and they look awful. But also, so your very nice village was obviously a bit more organised. But that my point would be, you know, people feel, if you watch any of the, like King Standing, for example, in Birmingham, there's more flags on one roundabout than I've probably ever seen in my whole life. And it's horrible because when you watch them doing it, they just want to belong. It's like being part of a gang. We're going out, lads, to put the flags up again. And it's like, what are you actually doing for your country? How are you actually living any values at all, apart from trying to frighten people? But I just want to say that I actually feel an element of, let me say, empathy for some of the people like that who are don't really know how to hang on and belong. And, you know, we're all very, like, I've never been lonely in my life. I've always had friends and people and community and all of that. And, of course, a lot of people don't have that. They don't know how to voice their concerns. They do feel, I do think as a country, we haven't dealt well with migration. Let me just say, I don't think we have. So what does that mean? What do we do about that? How do we settle people? So I just wanted to sort of say that it isn't just a good versus bad either. And the really organised and the kind of leadership seems to be one thing, and that is very scary, and the people funding GB New and all the other things. But then also other people that are showing up at some of this stuff or being on the Facebook groups or making the comments, give us our country back, you know, lock up your daughters, they're not safe from the migrants and the Muslim. That stuff is coming out of somewhere else as well. And I don't think we should just dismiss those people in a kind of look down at them way, because I just don't feel comfortable about that.
Thank you for saying that. I think if you were to actually look at the numbers of people who attend some of these marches, I think you'd find half of them are going there to find out what's happening, because I know quite a few people who have gone to these marches to kind of have conversations and to genuinely trying to understand, some of whom are my team at Theos. So Theos team researchers went to the May march and also the Putting Christ, the Christmas one, which was much smaller. And one of the things that they came back with, which I found really, really disturbing, was actually what we found was a lot of people of genuine faith. So this idea that basically these people are appropriating Christianity, but they are not themselves Christian, that is a problem, and that's also incorrect. Intertwined with Christianity or British Christianity or English Christianity are some of these ideas that people need to genuinely wrestle with at a kind of theological level as well as elsewhere. But as was said, the comms is really good, Unite the Kingdom. For some people, for a lot of people, they, you know, they are extremely dissatisfied with their life at the moment. They're scared, they have no money, they have no jobs, they might be facing all sorts of different challenges, and they might be putting all of that into a bucket of, right, these people are saying something and doing something. Also complicated within these marches are, there are black people in these marches, there are black and brown people, there are people of colour who are also sometimes anti-Islam. Some of them facing and seeing their own sense of kind of dissatisfaction with their state. So it's very, very complicated, these issues. And the more and more we can talk about the nuance, but also do something that's clever, comms-wise, I think we will be able to meet the challenge. But before we go on to Q&A from the audience, I want to do a sharp turn to the positive before we hand over the mic to others, which is what, not necessarily what makes you feel hopeful, but what practically can Greenbelters do in this conversation? What can we do? Pete?
After Nick Lowell spoke yesterday, I listened to a couple of people after they left, and one of them said, there wasn't one thing to do. He didn't give us one thing to do, and this all feels like it's going to take a long time, doesn't it? And I feel like my bad news for Greenbelters is there is not one thing to do here, and yes, this is going to take us a long time. Like, I feel like whilst I was sleepwalking, this has been coming for decades, and this is going to take us to work together for decades to respond to this. And sadly, as an organisation that has encouraged many of you to sign a petition, do a postcard, go on a march, there is not one thing. And I think all of us in this moment need to find the right ways to engage, where we, you know, we can draw on what it is we bring to this response. And it's going to be really different depending on who you are, where you live. So that's really difficult. But I guess there are a number of things that we can do together. And Julia will talk about one and I'll talk about another. Like one of the things Nick talked about really well yesterday, I think, was how so much of the rise of the far right is driven by pessimism. And this feeling that everything in our country and in our communities is getting worse. And so one of the key things that Hope Not Hate worked with Christian Aid and lots of others this last year was on something called A Million Acts of Hope. And the idea was, when that Tommy Robinson march was happening in May earlier this year, that we wanted the narrative not to be, you know, Britain's going to the dogs and there are lots of problems here, but for us to have a national conversation about all the wonderful things that are happening in our community. And of course, you know, like when I was talking to Hope Not Hate about it, and I was saying, oh yeah, you know, we need to be encouraging people to love their neighbour and to do things to do that. You know, someone from Hope Not Hate said to me, Pete, it's not about telling people to love their neighbour. It's about showing that people are loving their neighbours every single day. And that's what we need to be shining a light on. I think doing that in interfaith ways was a key thing in A Million Acts of Hope, showing communities locally who are working together. So we really just had this week where we just tried to shine a light on all the millions of things in our community that give us hope. And that might sound soft and fuzzy and warm and woolly, but trust me, the experts at Hope Not Hate are telling us that is what we need to do. We need to be shining a light on that stuff. So we're going to be doing it again next May, A Million Acts of Hope. Search the website. Christians, churches, other faith communities got involved, but nowhere near at the level that we need to be involved. As Julia said, we need to wake up, we need to be doing this in much larger numbers. When I think about the tens of thousands of us who are on the streets in Birmingham back in 1998 for Jubilee 2000, right? Greenbelt was right at the heart of making that happen. I want us to be right at the heart of being that visible again, but not in one place in Birmingham or London, in our communities, showing that we love our neighbours, showing that this wonderful stuff is happening every day, and telling a better story of who we are and of what the Christian faith is.
Lucy, briefly, and then Julie.
Yeah, very briefly. I mean, I can't really do better than that, I don't think, except to say perhaps we need stronger and better theology to be underpinning the demonstration, and I'm using that word advisedly, the demonstration of what Christian community can look like, which is diverse, inclusive, the things that we've been talking about, that is Orthodox Christian and authentic Christian expression of what it is to be together in community. And that is an important and strong narrative to promote. So I think that's not just for leaders. I think it's for every person who wants to be a follower of Jesus to say that and to do that as strongly as possible. But I think also it's more about actions than words, which is just contradicting slightly what I've just said, but it's actions in the sense of, I mean, find someone that you really disagree with and talk to them, but not going in order to persuade them. You know, we can all smell that a mile off. Just try to engage with a person or a group that you really fundamentally disagree with, as long as that's a safe thing to do. I'm assuming that that's a safe thing. If it's not safe, obviously don't do that. But if there is a way of us committing to having those conversations in an authentic way, I think that is also part of our Christian vocation. And it's also not to be, as to use your word, soft and fuzzy. It's not about that. It's about, from a position of strength, determining to engage with a narrative that is really different, and not just different, toxic from what the Christianity that we might want to espouse. But engagement has to be the way with the people who might be coming to those rallies, not necessarily the leaders, who need a different approach. And just very finally, very briefly, I think that the archetype for this is in the Gospels. Jesus called out injustice and systemic injustice all the time, attacked leaders really vociferously, verbally, violently sometimes, and at the same time was healing the daughter and the family members and the household members of the people who were being led by those leaders. So it's not inauthentic or disingenuous to have different approaches to the people who are weaponizing those Christian symbols and the people who are perhaps being drawn along by that without being patronizing in any way. That sort of authentic engagement, I think, is possible and important.
I just also want to give a shout out to the proper hardcore Greenbelters that are still here in the rain.
Absolutely.
It's amazing.
We see you.
Really. I really am appreciating you right now. I see all of you. So I wanted to just say, I was thinking earlier, and I felt the urge to say it now, you know, the kind of what would Jesus do thing, peace be upon him. Really, like, what would he actually do? And this is what he would do. And I think that, you know, this country is better for its diversity. It's also better for its faith communities. And we people of faith, Christians, I would say in this context in particular, and others, we need to be much more radically, positively out there with our faith and wear it on our sleeve and not be so kind of British and a bit quiet about it. Because we have a lot to bring to the table, and we are, and COVID, everyone always talks about it, but COVID really showed it, that the faith communities in this country are really the backbone of this country, in my view. And sometimes, you know, the numbers and the polls and the stuff, you don't really get that, but actually, I think we need to go from here being much more radical, in a good way, about, like Jesus was, about calling out the stuff, standing up for what we know is right, and doing it together. And, you know, for me as a Muslim, I would say that Muslims right now are really feeling it. It's really genuinely scary. And I would say that people need to do what we've always done in this country, which is to stand up and speak out and stand with and invite people in. Don't underestimate that the inviting people into your home for a meal is not pink and fluffy, trust me. It's a radical, beautiful thing to do, and it might feel weird at first, but once you do it, it just always works. Like, if you haven't realised it already, it just does work. So invite people in, go to people's things. If you're part of a church or an organisation or a community, whatever, you have got power then. So open the door, invite people in. It's very rare for people to say no to any of that stuff. And this applies to all of us. So we just need to be a bit more proactive, positive, loud, but still in a polite British kind of way. But do that thing. Because, you know, that's the only way. We've been too polite for too long, I think. And we know that we all want to work together. And the vast majority of the people in this country are good people. Beyond just this, right? We're in a beautiful bubble here, of course. I don't even want to go home, right? But the point is, the vast majority of people in this country are absolutely good people. I love this country. I'd never want to live anywhere else. But we have to be a bit more bold about that. And those of us that feel like activists or have a role or have money or whatever, we need to just be a bit louder about that.
Okay, over to you for questions. We have about 10 minutes, and I think that'll be three questions. I'm going to start over here because I feel like I can't... They're like... maybe... Two mics, okay. We'll take three questions. One from there, middle, and one over there. Please choose for me because I hate this.
I'm going to try and articulate this as possible. I'm not the best at doing it sometimes. I think we've talked about GB News, we've spoken about challenging political leaders, but I also wonder about our relationship with the media, with other mainstream media. I think the complicity of BBC News, Sky News in a lot of the rhetoric that they continue to platform. I include Christian media outlets in that. Premier Christianity also platform a lot of some horrific opinion articles on that will continue to do that. And I wonder if Christian Aid, Theos, Church of England have strategies of if they're changing their relationship with mainstream media outlets to combat some of this rhetoric, and I guess it's twofold. What are you doing is organisationally to have that, change that relationship, but also what can we be doing individually to change our relationship or have a healthy relationship with some of those media outlets as well?
Good question. Thank you. So, one about media. Is there a mic with someone already?
Yeah, sorry, we've taken them. Yeah.
Hello, thank you for everything. I hear an awful lot about Christian values, but I don't, from all sorts of people, but I don't ever hear anybody actually saying what they are. I wonder if you could just elucidate and see if how we can get those values themselves into the public debate.
Thank you. Christian values?
Lovely, thank you. I really enjoyed the talk, thanks so much. So I work in a forensic team in the north of England and do a lot of work with Prevent. We have a lot of referrals for those kinds of things. And it strikes me that one thing we haven't really heard about very much in this talk is social media. Because what I see in clinical practice is echoed a lot of what you said. Your empathy towards that is lovely, and I think that shows you're obviously clearly really, really thought about it. But I think what we have talked about, and I think what's important for us to think about what we can do next, is this online echo chamber of like this really quick dismissal of views I don't agree with. And online, you can see how that happens. You scroll the reel, there's one I don't agree with, I just skip to the next one, and then there's something that reinforces my belief. And I don't know how we can get into that. Because what I also found is a lot of the people that will hold these views, they're not the people that go to my church. They're not the people that would go to church, so I would feel safe as an LGBT person. So I think there is something about how do we get to those bits that we can't get to in the way. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Thank you. So let's have a rapid answering of those questions, and we'll see where we get to. I know that there are so many people who want to ask questions in the room, but we'll see what we can do. So there's a question about basically how do we beat the algorithm and the echo chamber? What are Christian values, and any strategies on media engagement? Any calling to you?
I was going to link the media and the social media. In that, I'm really sorry, I don't have an answer to that question. I've been in so many rooms over the last 12 months talking about how we respond to both the rise of Christian nationalism and the rise of the far right, and thinking about what part do each of us have to play in that. And of course, there's a big dimension of this which is around how things are talked about and engaged with in multiple media spaces. And I feel like those of us engaging in this space is, you know, it's an awful expression, a sort of bringing a knife to a gunfight kind of thing. Do you know what I mean? Like, it just feels like we are so ill-equipped to be able to engage in that space. So I'm really sorry. I honestly think that as we have these discussions, that is where we are. Now, I think there's an interesting piece. You know, if we have something to give, perhaps it is particularly in the Christian media space. And maybe there is something particularly that we need to be investing in more there and thinking about there. Because I think I worry a lot about how some of the attitudes that we are hearing about in Christian nationalist type circles or in what we might see as fringe denominations or groups start to permeate into other parts of the church and other voices come up. So how, I am totally unengaged in social media and digital space. How do we invest in and support those people who want to step into those spaces? Not least because it's awful, and it, you know, I think like Lucy talked earlier in her panel about the abuse that she's faced on occasions online. But I think there is something about how we identify, support, and invest in individuals who do want to be voices in those space. If we were to take a separate sector, the Trade Union Congress are working with people like Hope Not Hate and others on how do you support local trade unionists to be those voices on TikTok and in other spaces. And maybe that's what we need to be doing in Christian spaces as well. Like, who are the vicars and others who are going to really resonate with some of the people who might be attracted to you know, far right and Christian nationalist ideas. So I think that's what we should spend some time thinking about.
Thank you. And some of you may have seen Reverend Luke Lana on the TUC social media, who did a brilliant kind of video. I don't know if Luke is here, but Lucy.
Just briefly, there's a resource which there's a book coming out next month by Maria Ressa. Some of you may know, a journalist from the Philippines, who has written a book called How to Stand Up to a Dictator. And next month, the book is A Citizen's Guide to How to Stand Up to a Dictator. And one of the things that she sometimes travels, but she's currently facing a prison sentence of 100 years for being a journalist who is calling out the abuses that she's seen in her own country. One of the things she really talks about is the power of the church in her context and faith groups. And essentially, it's about money and power. And I think we're often a little bit reticent to talk about that. Sometimes we think about what would Jesus do? And I was saying earlier, we have to imitate Jesus, which is essentially to be, you know, a solo agrarian worker walking, you know, it's not about copying Jesus. It's about following Jesus back to our Christian values question. I think that therefore having funding an oppositional, a different voice in those media spaces and on social media is really important. And we're sometimes a bit worried about talking about money, but we have to talk about money. There is a lot of money in this tent right now. You look reassuringly rich. What I mean is, even if you don't think of yourself as rich, right? There is a lot of power in this place. And we, to get in various different ways, Hope Not Hate is one of them. The other organizations that might be in this space, fund those organizations well, make amplify voices in the social media spaces that are able to articulately place a different view forward. I think that is part of it. And Maria Ressa's really strong about saying to church communities, you are too reticent. And the long term strategy is education, she says. The short term strategy, the medium term strategy is legislation. And the short term strategy she calls hand to hand combat, and is not shying away from that. that is the space that we're in. But there's a long-term vision, there's a medium-term vision and a short-term vision, and the short-term vision is to fund people properly. Christian values, I would say, I suppose I go back to the fruits of the Spirit, sorry to be boringly biblical, but love, joy, we're sometimes not too joyful. Love, joy, peace, patience, kindness. Somebody else will finish it. Yes, I know. I'm kidding. And self-control, that's the one we all like. Thank you.
Anything to add? So I think, just to say on the Christian values, it's deliberately broad, isn't it? That is kind of, it's supposed to be vague and nebulous, so you can put whatever you want into it. And just on the media strategy, there are some people who are so brave, like people like Krish Kandaya, or sometimes yes. Steve Chalk, who go on to GB News and will face the enemy, and to try and have the conversations. I think we need to be much more supportive of those people, rather than say, how could you enter that platform? And there are some people who are really brave, and we should support them in doing that. Oh, I think we have run out of time. I'm sorry. Thank you so much. Maybe we can have a few minutes of being around if there are some burning questions that people want to ask. But thank you so much to Pete Morey, Reverend Lucy Winkett, and Julie Siddiqui.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.